Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You are now listening to British Brothers, the True Crime Podcast.
Hello everyone and welcome to British Murders, the podcast that focuses exclusively on British murder cases and serial killers. I'm your host Stuart Blues and I have a special guest joining me for this episode. Please welcome to the show forensic anthropologist Sam Rennie. Welcome Sam.
Thank you kindly. Thanks for having me.
It's cool to have you on. So I reached out to Sam Christ knows how long ago, but because of Sam's busy schedule, are you at Bournemouth, right?
Yeah, I'm down south in Bournemouth.
Bournemouth Uni. So we've had a bit of back and forth and we've finally managed to connect today because I've been desperate to get a forensic anthropologist on the show. The reason being is whenever I read a true crime book or read a case report from an article online, I see forensic anthropologist X, Y, and Z came in and found out that this happened. And I just... Can you explain to me in layman terms what a forensic anthropologist is and what they do?
So to make it very simple, we work on the identification of human remains. Full stop. that's essentially real boiled down to it. The forensic bit is normally we work within like the legal system of whatever country we reside in or being asked to work in. So for us, it's okay. Set of remains are here. Can you tell us, A, are they human?
Right.
If it is, then it's like, okay, what can you tell me about them? You know, male, female, age at death, how tall they were, just to kind of build up a little profile of who they are and then how that can aid in an investigation to identify someone.
So is this typically when a body is found that for whatever reason, the team isn't able to identify that person's identity?
Yeah, so it's normally when, like, it's kind of, how do you put it? Like on TV, whenever they see it and they always say, oh, can you identify this victim? And a family comes over and they visually identify them. And they go, that's my brother, that's my sister, that's, you know, my loved one. It's when that's not possible. So normally we work with either the human skeleton or it could be like heavily burnt remains, heavy decomposition, mummified remains, that type of world.
How common are mummified remains?
More so than you would think. It's not solely in ancient Egypt. It's normally when the body is just completely dried out into a husk.
Right.
And that's technically mummification.
Is there not a risk of... I can't remember what Indiana Jones film it was where he unearths a mummy and it just disintegrates because of the age. Is there a risk of that at all?
No and yes. Yes and no, both at the same time. One is Indiana Jones. I don't believe that movie actually exists. I don't believe that there's four Indiana Jones movies. The fourth one doesn't exist. Okay. 1 to 3, all good four.
You're a hater of the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Nah, it doesn't even exist. Okay. It doesn't exist.
Okay. But what about the disintegrating body?
So we can kind of get that, maybe not to that extent, but it all depends on the preservation of the remains, especially if they're in the ground. So if they're like, if they've been waterlogged for decades and decades and stuff like that, and then they dried out and then they get waterlogged again and then they get dried out again and then they get waterlogged again, just due to like environmental processes that we see every day, the remains then turn into, you obviously we've got decomposition, so it then turns into bone. But then it's something that, you know, when I was training and I still describe it now, is the remains turn into something like biscuit crumbs.
Right, okay.
Where you'll kind of touch it and you can feel how fragile it is. And you lift it and it leaves like a little powder on the ground because it's slowly flaking off. So the whole disintegration thing does happen, but not really in like a...
Yeah, not instantaneous.
Yeah, it's not instantaneous. It's more of a, you can normally just feel it and it's just like, right, everything, the bone is just flaking.
Okay.
And it's normally just due to it being dried and then waterlogged, dried, waterlogged, and that constant process.
Okay.
Yeah.
What does the training look like? So let's say I want to become an anthropologist.
Yes.
How do I go about that, first of all? And let's say I get accepted onto some course miraculously. What does my training look like?
It all depends. There's several routes in which you can kind of go through it. You can either do, sadly, you can't just do an undergraduate degree, a bachelor's degree, and then you can sign yourself off and go, "Hey, this is who I am now."
Mm.
It does require you to do more. So normally we see a lot of students either do their undergraduate degree, their bachelor's of science in forensic anthropology. There's a couple of courses in the UK which focus on that. You've got one at Liverpool John Moores and then one up at Dundee. They seem to be kind of like the big hitters when it kind of comes to it. But that's not saying if you don't go to those places, you can't do anything. It then, you can go from studying straight up archaeology or medical science, anatomy, life sciences. So as long as you've got an understanding of humans, you can kind of then, for your undergraduate, that's kind of like how you can work it. It is better to go and do a master's degree, you know, because that's where we can do a little bit more heavy training with you, you know, dealing with remains in a specific way, how to think, we call it thinking forensically. So the types of questions that you're going to start asking yourself, like, oh, okay, I'm going to be analyzing this as a particular way and thought process that you'll do it. And then kind of like once you've done kind of like that master's, that's kind of like when you can kind of start branching out into being a practitioner. It's very difficult to be a practitioner, especially in the UK. We're just an island. There's not that many dead people that need our attention, to be honest. You know, our climate is rather temperate, you know, so a lot of the stuff can be dealt with by a forensic pathologist and the coroners. It's very easy. It's more of a rarity that, you know, the remains are in such a state that we get called in.
So what sort of countries would be more likely to require someone in anthropology?
All over. Forensic anth is huge in the US. But the US is huge.
Mm.
And it's got, you know, so there is a large call for that. And the way their system works, they're more integrated as well. But I used to live over in South Africa, and there's a huge call out for identification of remains there. You know, it's a very large country with a very high murder rate per capita. So there's always something to do.
I like how you call it forensic anth. Is that what
forensic
anth?
Yeah,
that's what those in the know call it.
No, it's just my shorthand. It's forensic anth, and then it's forensic path for forensic pathology, forensic arc for forensic archaeology.
Yeah.
I'm just lazy. Forensic
good
tops.
For an anthropologist to be lazy.
Yeah, exactly. We always find the easiest ways to do things.
Forensic talks, yeah. Do you work closely with forensic archaeologists? Because I know they're different, but they seem quite similar. What kind of is the big difference between the two?
So normally it all depends on how we play together. So the times when we'll kind of play together in that type of thing, the forensic archaeologist is really good at, say, that location of clandestine graves. You know, graves that don't want to be found at all, you know, or we're talking mass burials.
Okay.
That don't want to be found. So they're really good at locating it. And as a forensic anth, or as part of my training that I did, I'm a good dog's body when it comes to archaeological excavation. Like, I can assist you in that. And since my specialism is in human remains, I know a bone the size of a thumbnail when I see it. So that's kind of like when we'll work together, they will kind of take point on that, and they'll understand the great, kind of like the site information. We call it the stratigraphy. So when we do an excavation and you see that we tend to go down in like a box, you know, with straight walls. So we can look at those straight walls and look at the stratigraphy. We can look at the different layers that's going, like, this is a new layer because we can see that new soil was put on top, whilst below it, it's the old soil.
Got you.
So we can kind of see that. And the forensic archaeologists are really good with that, really good at planning, really good at recording, noting where everything is in this potential grave to the minutia, what it is, how do you record it? And then we'd kind of work together then as a team to lift the remains out of that burial site. So that's when we kind of work together. So they're in charge of the entire grave.
Right. So they say, dig there, and you say, yes, sir.
Oh, for me, yeah, because I'm a dog's body, and they'll just be like, do you have your trowel? Yes, I have my trowel. No, Sam, stop. Don't do that. Okay, no problem. So, yeah, and then when the human remains are kind of like lifted, that's when it becomes more of the forensic anthropology's domain, because the forensic archaeologist has got their gravesite and they're doing all the recording for that. It's now, say, my job to analyze what has been lifted, analyze those human remains to kind of aid us in trying to figure out who they were.
What's the first step of that analysis look like?
It all depends on the situation that you kind of get the remains in. But the first question that we all ask ourselves as soon as we get given something, be it from the police or as soon as we've lifted something, is it human?
Can you know on site by now?
Half the time, yeah. As in, yeah, I've spent 10 years looking at, over 10 years looking at human remains. So we've got a good eye for it. I can look at a picture and be like, that's not human. That could be a sheep. Or that's last night's KFC that's been dumped in the street. And that happens more often than not. Or it's just like, those are like pork ribs. So that's the first question that we always kind of ask ourselves whenever we get handed something is this human? Because if it's not human, then it doesn't fall within my role because I focus on humans.
So let's say then some remains have been found. And in this case, however it's been identified, you know it's human.
Yeah. Our next step is, it's something that we call MNI, which stands for minimum number of individuals. So whilst we're doing that, we take notation of like how well preserved the remains are in, you know, are they biscuit crumbs? You know, are they in tiny, small pieces, heavily fragmented like a jigsaw? Or are we dealing with a complete bone? And how much of the skeleton is there? Is it skull to toes? You know, is it all present or is it just bits and pieces? But we perform this analysis called an MNI, so minimum number of individuals, because normally sometimes we can just be given things, just a box, and be like, here you go. And it's just like, okay, how many people are in this box? So the way that we go around that is we lay the remains out in something called anatomical position. We lay them out on a table as if a person was lying on the table with their palms facing up, you know, just stretched out, you know, just having a nice relax and laid out. And because we're laying the skeleton out and stuff like that, if we see any duplicated bones, I know you've only got two upper arm bones, your humerus.
Yeah.
I know you've only got two of them, and I know you've only got one on the left and one on the right. And if I find something that is another right humerus, then I know I'm dealing with more than one person. That's then kind of like, oh no, I'm dealing with more than one. Okay, now I've got to try and pass out who these individuals are to make sure I get two individuals or three individuals and not Frankenstein them together.
Right. Okay.
So we normally do that. It then takes a lot more. It then takes further analysis, which then goes into our next steps, which is broadly termed, we create a biological profile. And that biological profile is, what can the bones tell us about who this person was biologically? Age at death, within a loose margin of error, you know, we're not as good as going, you know, they are 36 years old and 3 months. It's normally like the person is between 35 and 45, or 45 and over.
Okay. And is this all data retrieved from the bones themselves, or is this the bones differ as people get older?
Yeah, so it's the bones. So we do go under kind of like this maturation process. So we all know that like babies have significantly more bones than an adult. So once we reach kind of that age of where we know that the child has kind of like stopped growing, so to speak, then we know that we've got 206 bones that we need to account for. And then as we age, we see age-related changes to certain areas of the skeleton. It's never really due to wear and tear, but it's just kind of like you can kind of see that the body has undergone a lot of processes, of life processes.
Right.
So we kind of look at certain areas of the skeleton to give us an idea of how old they were. If it's a kid, sadly, it's a lot easier because we, up until, I would say, well, especially when they're younger, we use teeth to age because we kind of know that the age of 12, like the second permanent molar that we have is normally erupting and it's normally pretty standard.
Okay. I'm just thinking, because you know, you hear like when you die, it's not to do with bones necessarily, but when you die, I was just thinking randomly, they say like your hair keeps growing, your nose and ears keep growing. Is that true?
No. It's not true, but from an outside perspective, it is. Because when you when you die, what actually happens is that, you know, you lose moisture, you lose a little bit of fluid, so you dry out a little bit, which means your skin contracts. So your hair growing, in inverted commas, it's just the hair actually showing more because the skin has receded slightly.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
So almost like the root would kind of be showing that kind of...
Yeah, not as far as the root, but you just get that little bit more kind of showing. So people go like, well, the hair wasn't that long before. And it's just like, true. But yeah, so it doesn't truly grow. It's kind of like people then say like, like your nails grow as well. And that's just due to a little bit more of a skin kind of just being more taut.
Well, Mythbusters, that's what this is. Should change the show name.
Should change the show to Mythbusters.
Yeah. How hard is it to, let's rewind it all the way back to the first set of remains that you worked on as a trainee, I assume. Is it hard to disassociate that from being a person, or to you, is it just work?
Would this be, not for when I was at uni, but would you say like my first forensic case?
Yeah, let's go first professional case.
My first professional case was a jump in the deep end. I'm not going to lie. So it was like, because it was so hectic, it was my brain can go into panic mode, but super professional. So I just kind of like, right, I'm in work mode now. This is what I need to deal with. Because my first full professional thing, I was working on a plane crash.
Wow.
So it was
Jesus.
Very much a, right, okay, this is what we're doing. And yeah, so it was a case of compartmentalizing, disassociation, that type of thing. But because there was so much happening, it was, right, okay, I know that what my job is, they are human, they're doing this. So there is a lot more care and attention because it is your first case as well. And you always want to try and, every case that you do, you want to do your absolute best to try and deal with this.
So I'm just, you know how it's mainly bones that you deal with, right?
Predominantly, yeah.
So what's, in theory then, bones must be in the ground a fair while before stuff like skin disintegrates and stuff. It's a really morbid question, but what's the freshest set of remains you've worked on? I know it sounds horrible to ask.
Plane crash.
Okay, so that's just happened and you've gone in, is that right?
Plane went down in November. I was there in February.
Okay, 3 months.
And it was gooey.
Wow.
Okay. Yeah, I saw, and even though like predominantly a lot of my training was on like skeletons and stuff like that, I still know my anatomy. I still know my soft tissue anatomy, and we also deal with soft tissue. So that's where my training in soft tissue really came into play, because it's just like, well,
So is the two separate aspects of anthropology then? There's the bone side and the soft skin side, or is it kind of one and the same?
It's kind of amalgamated into one, as in you'll have those who are more, who will purposely train themselves solely more in the dry bone, because they know within themselves that I don't want to deal with flesh. I don't want to deal with, I want to deal with stuff that's just bone.
It's probably easier to disassociate if it's just bone.
So it sounds horrible. It really is, because they don't, I don't want to say there's not much of a smell, because there is, but it is one of those. It's just like, yeah, I look at a skull, but there's still no face there.
Yeah.
So yeah, for some people, it's a lot easier to disassociate. For me, it's, I don't want to say I'm happy with either, because that makes me sound like a weirdo. But it's, I can work well with both.
So let's take it the other way then. What's the oldest set of remains you've come across?
I've dealt with is 10,000 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
So my history's not great. What time period is that? Is that ancient Egypt, or is that bloody...
So that is, it's hunter-gatherers.
Okay.
So it's kind of, and that is in Mexico.
Right. 10,000. Wow.
10,000 years.
Give or take 10,000 either side.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I'm trying to think. The dating on that, I think it's like give or take 400 years, but don't quote me on that.
Okay. Okay.
But yeah, so that's wow. The oldest. And I remember when I first looked at it, I was there in Mexico, and I got brought in and it's like, hey, we've got this. So I just hold it. I just hold the skull in my hands and I go, oh yeah, by the way, Sam, this is 10,000 years old. It's like the second oldest complete skeleton in the Americas. And I'm like, you are telling me this whilst I'm holding it. Like, you should have told me this before. Like, yeah, don't tell me whilst I'm holding it. So yeah, so that's the oldest. So that's them obviously leaving the profession of forensic anthropology. And that's going more into the general overarching profession of biological anthropology,
mm-hmm.
where we just deal with people.
What is the, if you can kind of describe the difference between what a 10,000 year old skull would look like versus one that, say, is between 0 and 5 years old? Is it the color, the size? The size, I assume, if it's 10,000, possibly.
The size is
quite a quick turnaround for evolution, but
just super quick. Yeah. The sizing of the thing, so that's very difficult to do. So we do know that there are, I don't want to say age related, because I don't want to get confused with the person's biological age, but like temporally, like in Earth time, Earth age, there is a difference in how the skull or the body kind of looks, mainly due to adaptation. Like, we're not hunter-gatherers anymore. Mm-hmm. We're currently sat down on hopefully comfy chairs.
Yep.
They weren't doing that 10,000 years ago. They were busy. They were always active. In terms of like, but then preservation is kind of like a big thing. So I would say like one of the biggest differences between a skull that I get called in, you know, from the police here, say, we found a skull, can you pop down to the morgue or can you pop around to have a look? And it's modern, it's grease, and it's the smell.
Right.
Because bone is a mixture of organic compounds and inorganic compounds. So that organic part of it is the bit that produces the smell and the grease and everything. And we can see the grease, we can feel the grease, and we can smell the grease that's on it. And we're just like, this is modern. This is definitely new. But if we're talking 10,000 years old, it's just dry. It is dry human bone.
So I'm guessing you mentioned like the biscuit consistency. Yeah. It's just hardened by that point.
It's hardened, yeah. That biscuit crumb consistency all is solely dependent on the environment that it's in.
Hotter climate in Mexico. Kind of
yeah, so it's a lot drier. However, the skeleton I was dealing with was found in the cenotes. So it's kind of found in those underwater cave systems.
Right.
So, and then our diver actually found it, retrieved it, spent God knows months and months doing pre-treatments on it so we could actually touch it without it disintegrating.
So has there ever been a case where you've been called in to identify someone via their remains, and for whatever reason you've not been able to?
It all depends on what's been kind of given to us. So in terms of my stuff, As in, we normally get, I'm trying to think off the top of my head now. So we normally get a lot of emails from police or stuff like that saying, like, they would have found something, they'll take a picture. Is this human? Yes or no? If it is human, right, okay, what can you tell us? And sometimes it's just like, all that's available is, say, the upper part of the upper arm bone, the humerus. And it's just like, I can only tell you so much. I can tell you it's human. I can tell you that it's the, you know, proximal portion of the humerus, which is the upper segment. I can most probably try to do a sex estimation on it to say, is it more likely to be male or female? And if it's an adult, as in over the age of 18, or if it's younger than 18, that's, and then full stop. There's nothing more I can tell you. That's when I would normally suggest, or just like, if, especially if it's modern, it's like one of the things you can do, like you can fork out money and we can take a sample for DNA, you know, and potentially we can try and get a hit that way.
Because normally you think of DNA as being more in skin cells and soft tissue, don't you, rather than bones. But I know that the
bone is actually really good in certain circumstances. So one of my, in the forensic anthropology realm and stuff like that, my main specialism, or the thing that I tend to more gravitate towards in like casework and being a practitioner, is more in the world of DVI, which is disaster victim identification. So it's more your mass fatality events, working on like plane crashes, tsunamis, building fires, more stuff like that. And it is one of those. So when it comes to DNA, it's just like, yeah, okay, we've got a body here. It's in heavy decomposition. We can't use the skin. We can't use the muscle because it's decomposing. It's not good enough, really. Okay, what can we take? We'll take a bone sample.
Is it as easy to get DNA from a bone as it is soft tissue, or is the process slightly different?
Well, we've got to cut into it.
Yeah.
there's a little bit more of a strength that needs to happen to get down to it. And you use a bone saw, something like
that. How much would you cut off, are we talking?
God, not a lot. So normally, if the body is complete but heavy decomp, we would take it from the femur, so from the thigh bone, and we'd take it from like the shaft, the main length of it. So we would do, so if the body is still fleshy, we would perform something with the forensic pathologist that's there with us, perform like an H incision. So cut the top, so cut deep at the top, cut deep at the bottom, draw a line down the middle, and then, sounds really,
I know what you mean though.
Horrific.
I know what you mean, yes.
Then, yeah. And then open it like a book.
Yep, got you.
We've got bone then, and then we can take a bone sample. And I would say it's like 2-3 centimeters all the way down in like a V, like a wedge. Pop it out, take it for sampling, close them back up. So bone is really good. Also teeth. Teeth are fantastic because teeth are not bone.
Is that the thing you go for first when trying to ID someone? Is it the teeth?
So we've got three rules when it comes to positive identification in that type of scenario: DNA, dental, and fingerprints. And that's normally the order we'll go in preference. We'll normally always try and do DNA. Then we'll try and do odontology or dental. We'll get a forensic odontologist, a forensic dentist in to do that. And then we'll go to the fingerprints as and then. But a lot of the forensic odonts and dental people that I know, I got on with quite a few of them, but I tell them that I do not like teeth in the slightest because they're small, they're finicky, you know, they're just, but they can tell you a lot of information. So what I normally like to tell them is I really like teeth because I get to extract it and destroy it for sampling.
Oh, God.
And they go, how could you do this? Like, there is so much more information you can get from it. I'm like, I'm getting DNA from it.
Like
really good.
Nightmare dentist pulling teeth with a big grin on his face.
Yeah, I know a lot of those.
Good God.
The story will continue after these quick messages.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
And now, back to the story.
Forgive me if I'm wrong, based on your accent, you sound Manc to me. Am I way off?
Nah, I'm Manc.
Manc, right. Yeah. How'd you end up in Bournemouth?
Nothing
against
was.
Bournemouth, by the way. Nothing against Bournemouth.
No, it's odd because I'm one of the few northerners where I am.
Do you get the piss taken out of you for it?
For how I pronounce certain things, absolutely. So I ended up in Bournemouth. So lived in Manchester. I studied in Liverpool for 8 years. Developed a slight Scouse twang.
Okay, that's interesting.
Which my folks obviously loved to pieces. Moved to South Africa, lost the Scouse, developed a weird South African Manc accent.
How long were you there?
Just over 6 months.
That quick, and you got a little twang.
I'm a person who will pick up accents. I'm a person who mimics accents when I hear it.
I do that too.
So yeah. Most probably talking to you, I'll become more northern.
Yeah, that's exactly.
Become more northern. Then moved back to the UK, moved back to Manchester, started to lose a little bit of the South African. Then job came up down in Bournemouth. So you move where the job is.
Absolutely, you do, yeah.
So, yeah, I ended up down south by the beach.
Yeah, I'm sure it's nice down there. Nicer than being in the middle of the country where there's no ocean.
It's one of those. I'm not a fan of the beach, though.
It's probably because you're a northwester like me.
Yeah.
We didn't grow up with it.
No, I don't really know what to do with myself. I'm like, oh, great. There's a bit of sand, a bit of water.
Well, the only experience we had really growing up was like Blackpool or Scarborough, wasn't it?
So, Blackpool, Southport, Scarborough. Gotta love it.
That's it. It's not the best experience. No offense.
Yeah, it's definitely not Blackpool down here.
Yeah, I can imagine, yeah. So I'm just on your LinkedIn profile here. So at the uni, let's have a look. I'm just reading through it now. So obviously you're the certified forensic anthropologist, FA3, is that? Am I saying that right? What's that mean? Is that the level that you're at? Or?
Yeah, so the UK a few years ago tried to develop a certification process, basically to try and stop it being a little bit more like the Wild West, you know, of people just saying, yeah, I'm a forensic anthropologist, you know, and then just doing stuff. So it's kind of like a way of making sure and keeping tabs, you know, right, these people here are at a certain standard, are going through the processes, X, Y, and Z. It's only been around for the past few years, so it's still kind of getting its legs, it's still trying to develop in what it needs to be. So in the UK we've got three levels. We've got 3, 2, 1, because we always like to do reverse order for some obscure reason.
Right, so 3 is the lowest of the
3 is the lowest, 1 okay. Is the highest.
I'm thinking it's the highest. Okay,
I know it's such a weird system. Like, I wasn't there when they created it, because I was just like, mate, just do it the other way around. But no, yeah. It was, so it's 3, 2, 1. And it's fairly new. Like, it took me a while to get onto it because I had already had quite a fair bit of experience before me. And they're like, oh, you need to document everything. And it's just like, I need to document 7 years worth of stuff. Right. I need to go back, trudge through all of my notes, trudge through everything and try and find it all. So then you can kind of get on the ladder to go, right, this is what I am. So you're kind of given like a mentor, just be like, oh, you know, so if you're starting off, they can, if there's a case that's happening, they could be like, hey, if you come here, you can observe and you can learn what you're doing. And then you kind of go up the ranks as you do.
I looked at it. I thought, oh, rank 3, highest.
Here we go.
Good stuff. I've got a hero.
Sorry, mate.
Entry level, amateur.
Yeah, you've got entry level. But to be fair, because it's fairly new, there are quite a lot of us. And there's quite a lot of us on that list of forensic and level 3s who have 15, 20 years worth of experience.
Yeah, but they've got a...
It's kind of like starting off, not at zero, but you're like, right, okay. And then you've just got to work your way through the administrative processes.
Yeah, it makes sense. So it looks like you've been there 4 years now, down at
Bournemouth. Yeah.
So you're teaching forensic investigation. Is that full time or that? Because how do you, if a copper emails you and said, you know, Sam, we've got some bones here. And you go, I'm teaching a course, mate. I'll pick this up on Monday.
So I'm full time at Bournemouth. So basically what happens, like if we get something, the police will email us, and it's not just me. There's like a small team of us at Bournemouth who deal with the police coming in, you know, with, oh, what's this? What's that? So there's another anthropologist on the team who's another lecturer. We've then got one of our demonstrators, lab managers, who also helps, and then a couple of people who are really good at identifying animal bones. So it's a group effort. So the email will come in. There'll be a picture, several pictures. They're like, hey, this has been found here. Can you tell us if it's human or not? You know, give us a bit more. And we'll have a look at it and we'll be like, or I'll look at it and be just look at the image and go, this is KFC. Don't really need to deal with anything. I just need to get this double checked by another person just to make sure that what I'm seeing is correct. And then we'll email them back saying, stand down. This is not human. If it is human, then it's just like, right, okay, do you want us out on site or are you collecting it and you want us down at the precinct or, you know, do you want us down in the morgue? And then we'll kind of work it that way. And then we'll try and find time to do it essentially. But that's when kind of like for me on my side, like I would work, I would say out of hours. So not that Monday 9 to 5, it's just like, oh, can you come down at 7 o'clock? Yeah, okay, mate. Sure. Yeah. But then it's like when it comes to the big stuff with like the mass fatalities, I'm on call 24/7, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year. So it's just like I can get a phone call and be like, hey, this has happened. Can you get on a plane in the next 4 hours? Can you get yourself to Heathrow? Or maybe not in the next few hours, but maybe like, can you fly out in the next 3 days? And you'll be gone for at least 3 weeks. So for that, I have an agreement.
I was going to say, what do the uni think of that?
The
students are like, sorry, there's no teacher for the next 6 months.
Sounds mate. See you later. Ciao. To be fair, my students are actually really good with it. So one of the classes I teach is all about disasters and how do you process forensically disasters. And I teach from my experience. I get a couple of my colleagues in to teach from their experience as well. And I was up front with them and it's just like, guys, if I get a call, you're not going to see me for 3 weeks. And they were just like, actually, we're really happy with that, because it's just like, it's really nice for them that the person that's lecturing them, the person that's teaching them, is a current practitioner.
Yeah,
we're not reading out of a textbook, we're not doing that type of thing. And it's just like, yeah, your timetable is going to be absolutely shocking when I come back. But like, we'll deal with it as and when.
It makes sense, because if you had someone teaching you who got out of the game 20 years ago, let's say, not that they wouldn't have great knowledge, but practices and processes, I imagine, change all the time.
Yeah, they're always updated. So that's what needs to be done. But it's fun. It keeps me on my toes.
It's like Batman getting a call like, that's my teacher.
Yeah.
That's my guy.
Yeah, I'm still waiting for the day that I'm on a deployment on a disaster with a former student of mine.
Oh.
I'm still waiting for that. I've nearly had it. They were a student of mine, but I knew them when they were a student. And I was just like, I looked at it, I was like, didn't know you were going to be here. They're like, didn't know you were going to be here. And it was fine.
Oh, I mean, it's a dark thought, but it's better to be called into a case with one of them than to find out that you've, you know,
having to deal with them on the other side. Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to ask a question, actually, about, you know, in recent weeks in the news, there was claims that some remains had been found on Saddleworth Moor.
I knew this question was going to come up.
And it turned out to be, as far as we know, a bit of a publicity stunt from an author or something, because they found nothing. Let's say, best case scenario, I know it's awful because, you know, poor Keith Bennett and the other four were brutally killed by Brady and Hindley. But if some remains were found, just going back to what you said about the amount of info you can give to an officer.
Yeah.
DNA with him, I don't think would be doable, because unless it's been taken in the 60s, which given he was, what, 10, it probably hasn't. Could you only realistically say to them, it's a kid aged between this and that? How much could you actually give them?
Yeah, pretty much. It'll be one of those. It'll be, right, okay, So it'll be age estimation, right? Okay, so it'll be like, okay, I've aged this skeleton to be between the ages of 8 and 10 years old. Full stop. Would also, you know, if there's any signs of trauma, like skeletal trauma, you know, any bone fractures or stuff like that, we would obviously note it and we'd tell them. But we would be like, okay, take a DNA sample, mate. Please take a DNA sample, because even though you won't have like a direct match because died when they were 10, like, okay, we're going to do a familial match.
Yeah.
We'll get family involved then. Mm-hmm. All we need is like a cheek swap and we'll be able to do the matching that way. So that'll be it. So the weird thing is in like for a forensic anthropologist, we very rarely can work on positive identification. Like this is so-and-so. Our job is mainly to whittle down the list. So we will go, okay, the skeleton that or the remains that I'm looking at, this is of a male individual. Okay, so on our list, we can cut out all females that are missing. Age range, oh, I'm dealing with, you know, somebody between the ages of 21 and 30. Okay, well, I can get rid of all the kids. I can get rid of all the OAPs. Get rid of all of that.
Is and that what over 30 is?
Oh, God. Because I'm classed as an OAP now. Cool. But we can get rid of all of those and we can kind of focus on this.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. What's the next thing? Oh, well, they're around about, I don't know, 178 centimeters tall. What's that in inches and feet?
Yeah.
You know, right. Do the conversion. Right. What type of antemortem information do we have? So the living information from the people that reported them missing or something like that, did they say that they were around about that tall? You know, so it means that you can kind of get rid of the people that are like 6'2". Get rid of those people. You can get rid of the people who are a lot shorter than that, and you can kind of look within that stature range and be like, right, okay, we've created now part of this biological profile. Now we need to go into stuff that is a little bit more detailed. Can we see any old trauma on, say, the skeleton, the human remains? You know, can we see an old fracture? You know, say that you've broken your arm when you were 15 and they died when they were 25. Well, we can still see signs of that on your skeleton. And that's actually really useful information for us, because if we don't see the signs that that bone has been broken, right, we can tick that person off the list. It's not going to be there. Right, okay, they didn't have this, we can tick this off. And then also certain types of diseases can leave an impact on the skeleton. So on the other spectrum, so say that the individual was in their 60s, we'll make it easier. Say the individual was in their late 30s, early 40s, yet they suffered really badly with arthritis. We would be able to see that on the remains. So it's just like, okay, we're actually... we've aged this person to be around about 30 to 40 years old, but we're seeing a high amount of arthritis in the hips. All right, okay. So we can then start filtering some people in, filtering some people out. We can build a much stronger profile, which then helps then like the people who are trying to find who it is a lot more to go on.
Makes sense. The way you've worded it is good with the filter. I just picture like an online filter when you're looking for something, shoes, clothes, anything. Obviously, this is slightly different.
Yeah.
But, you know,
same process.
Yeah. 6 foot, male, arthritis. And even, you know, if they had like a bunion or something with the bone shape.
Something like that. Or, you know, did they have any surgery that would have impacted part of the skeleton or anything, hip replacement, shoulder replacements, stuff like that? That is fantastic for us, because if you get a hip replacement, shoulder replacement, knee replacement, it comes with digits on the replacement. And we can go, cool, contact the manufacturer, because that's associated with a specific person.
So weird, isn't it? Like the barcode and stuff or whatever, a serial number on these.
Serial numbers, yeah, it's really
useful. I assume
useful.
That's why they do that though, right? That must be part of the reasoning as to why they do that.
It's really good to have, yeah.
It's really morbid as well.
Yeah, to be fair, my life is pretty morbid, but this is a normal conversation for me. So
I feel like you've got to have a certain personality to work within the field. Am I right in thinking that?
Yeah, weirdly, a lot of us are like, we're not doom and gloom when you talk to us. We're not like, oh, today's terrible, oh, this. It's we're generally quite upbeat in like day-to-day life and everything else. And then like we become serious when we're obviously working.
Yeah.
But all of us just seem to have kind of like a very like friendly outward personality type thing. Not saying that like extroverted, a lot of us are heavily introverted, but it's that type of thing. And it's personally, I think that helps with some of the nature of what we deal with, because we deal with some of the worst things imaginable.
Yeah.
So the fact that we're generally quite upbeat, I think it helps us combat what we're dealing with.
Definitely. I think being what I would call maybe of a helpful nature.
Yeah.
And an investigative nature. So you're going to go out your way to, you know, find out as much as you can about these remains.
Yeah, that's normally, it's what one of my friends says to me as well. It's whenever we do the big cases, like the disaster victims, plane crashes or war crimes, stuff like that, we normally go in because of the type of people we are. We know it's very difficult and the likelihood of it happening is very small. We always go, I want to identify everyone. I want to make sure, I will try tooth and nail. I will give everything that I can to try and get that identification to go through. And it's all about that. Like we said, it's like giving personalities. Like the other way that we kind of look at it is if the roles were reversed, I would really hope that somebody out there with a very obscure skill set was going to try and give me back my name if I was ever brutally murdered and whatever. So it's kind of like I'm putting in the effort that I would kind of expect from another person.
Do you feel that people in, I think it's fair to say that your role's pretty niche.
Yeah.
Do you think people within roles such as yours or forensic archaeologists or all the different type of ologists you can have within forensics, yeah, do you think they're kind of underappreciated, not necessarily by the cops and the people on the investigations, but by the general public? Because I feel like a lot of the roles people don't even know exist and it kind of goes on behind the scenes.
Yeah, as in like my field, there's a lot of us. Public perception massively changed because you had all the names have now completely gone. You had the Kathy Reichs books that came out, which then led on to the TV show Bones, which really put a massive light on what my profession supposedly was, massive dramatization. But it is kind of one of those. It's like, okay, I don't kind of mind the fact that it's a little bit underappreciated or kind of unknown. Because the way I see it is that I don't really want to be seen. If I'm out on a case, I don't want to be pinpointed as, hey, look, that's Sam. Oh, what's he doing? Oh, something bad's happening.
Right, got you.
I like the fact that there is a little bit of, for the public side, anonymity that comes with it. Because then also, like, it's very difficult then if we're working on a big case that's disaster-based, we don't want then people who've been affected by it finding us and going, have you managed to identify this person? So the fact that they kind of don't know we exist is actually sometimes really helpful.
Well, this is just going to be an audio episode, so people will know you exist now.
Oh, yeah, no, it's fine. Yeah, it's cool. Cool. I knew what I was getting myself into.
It's really interesting, though. It's one of those aspects of true crime that it's, again, fleetingly, even in true crime cases, because it's to do with stuff that you can't identify straight away, which is probably rarer than people appreciate, maybe.
In the UK, yeah.
Yeah, in the UK. Yeah, it's just one of those jobs, and I thought, you know, I need to ask what that's all about, but I really appreciate your candor.
And
it's been interesting to hear from you, so I really appreciate you giving up your time today.
Nah, it's cool. It's always nice to talk about the profession in a very easy way. It's like, for me, it's like I hear it everywhere, but I'm in the profession, so I should be hearing it everywhere. Yeah. And I've got a lot of students who are kind of like, oh, I really want to get into this profession. It's just like, right, okay, then you're in for the long haul. It's not easy at all. You really have to fight for it.
You can't just dip your toe in.
Sadly not, which, to be fair, that's how a lot of us kind of operate. Like, I'm full-time at the university, but I still work on the side as a practitioner. because there's not that many roles as a full-time practitioner in the UK.
Makes sense for the reasons you've said, yeah.
Yeah, I think there's only like four.
But you can tell Sam's passionate about his job because behind him, I don't know if you're at home or at the office now, but there is a full skeleton display, which I assume is not real.
It is not real, no. I'm at home. But yeah, I've had him since I was an undergraduate student. So I've had him for like 11, 12 years.
Wow. He's aged wonderfully.
Yeah, he's done really well. The thing is that when it was lockdown and we had to teach online, he became really useful to teach because I had to dismantle him.
Has he got a name?
His name is Gibbs.
Gibbs, okay.
Yeah.
Hello, Gibbs.
Yeah, Gibbs, he's been through thick and thin. Really good listener. Doesn't talk that much, which is fine, but...
He's not got ears.
Very supportive, yeah. Strong, silent type.
Oh, dear. No, it's been a pleasure, bud. Really appreciate you coming and speaking to me and telling me and my listeners about anthropology. Thanks for your time. Any final parting thoughts?
Not really. It's one of those. It's the... When it comes to forensic anth, it all depends on what you want to specialize in as well. You can be a trauma specialist if you want. So you can really study, like, we call it fractography. So fracture patterns, what type of weapon did they use and stuff like that. You can do facial reconstruction. You've got a skull, try and build a face on it. For me, I study human variation. And my specialist is DVI, so working on mass, so like mass fatality events, which is fun in my eyes because it keeps me busy. But yeah, so forensic anth, it's even though it's a niche area to be, it can also be very broad in how you actually work it.
Is there anything you wish you'd have known when you first started? Perhaps a piece of advice you could give to your younger self?
Slow down. Slow down, because it feels like for me, I kind of, not like I rushed into it, but part of it is just like, it would have been good if I just took a lot, just my time a little bit more, you know, just to appreciate more of the other stuff that happens in life instead of deep diving into this.
Okay. I can imagine with something like this, it'd be all encompassing and it'd be like, you'd live, breathe, sleep, dream it. And then you wake up 10 years later and think, oh, wow.
Yeah, okay. It's kind of what it is. Yeah. Like my first case was when I was 20, when I was 23 years old, the plane crash. And it's just like, oh man, that was like so long ago. But I'm like, I haven't stopped since. I'm like, where did my 20s go?
Yeah, they do fly by. What do you wish you could do or could have done more of them? How do you fill your free time when you get any?
If and when. The thing that I would, it's not necessarily due to the profession that destroyed it, it's more due to doing a PhD that destroyed it. Reading for pleasure, yeah. Reading for fun. I still, like, I'll pick up a book and I'll start it and I'll get like this little pinch of guilt, like, if you've got time to read this, you've got time to read a research article. Oh, if you've got time to read this, then you've got time to be writing this. So it's really trying to unlearn that aspect. And the same with like gaming as well. As soon as I pick up PlayStation controller or like my Switch, it's just like, surely you should be doing this. And it's just like, oh, okay.
You sounded like that. Is it the Royal Navy advert where it goes, if you can fix a car, you can fix a Harrier jet. If you can fix a jet, you can fix a space rocket. I know what you mean though. You get that kind of guilt, don't you? Sometimes it happens. Like if I'm watching TV one night, it's like, bear in mind, like yourself, work full time. Yeah. On the side, I don't look at human remains in person,
no.
But I read about them for the pod.
Yeah.
And if you sit down and watch TV one night, you think, this is a wasted hour of my life. I could be doing something. It's weird, isn't it? You find it hard to sit there and do nothing.
Yeah. And I'm still graduated in, 2018? It's now 5 years and I'm still dealing with the guilt of like, oh, let's just deal with this. No, read this instead, do this. So that's the one thing that I wish I could get back into. But that isn't necessarily, like I said, that's due to more of the academy, not the being a practitioner.
Makes sense. Busy job working at a uni, I imagine.
It's, yeah. nonstop onslaught. Let's go.
Yeah. As long as you love it, which I think by the sounds of it, you do.
It's one of those. It's my go-to thing. I say it keeps me out of trouble.
That's always good. I think what we should do, Sam, is for those listening, this is the third recording we've had to do with Sam because of my shocking internet. So I think before we keep going on into multiple double digits here, again, it's been so much pleasure for you to speak to me. Thanks for your time. But I think we'll end it there, if that's okay.
Yeah, no problem.
Cool. For everyone else listening, this comes out on a Monday at the time of recording. I don't know when that'll be. But on Thursday, there's going to be an episode of some description. I'm not that far in advance as far as planning goes, but there will be an episode on Thursday. So we'll catch you all next time, and thanks for listening.